The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at Lead Lag Report on Twitter to join these conversations live. And check out the Lead Lag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets. And now, on to our Lead Lag Live discussion hosted by Michael Guyad.
My name is Michael Guyad, publisher of the Lead Lag Report. Joining me today is Warren Pies. So, Warren, introduce yourself to the audience. Who are you? What's your background? How'd you get interested and involved in markets? And what are you currently doing with your research?
All right. Thanks for having me. Just about myself and my background. At present, I'm the founder or co-founder of 314 Research. We are a quantitative macro research shop. And so basically institutional. So our clients are institutional investors worldwide. Before I started 314, I ran the commodity team at Ned Davis Research. I was at Ned Davis for like a decade. And there was like kind of a long winding road to get to that position there. But I was kind of known more or less for my coverage of the oil and energy markets. During my time at NDR, we obviously cover the entire global macro picture now at 314. But before that, if we go back even farther, I was an attorney. I worked on regulatory approvals doing land use stuff, a lot of stuff with the phosphate mining industry. And so that was kind of a weird route, but some of the stuff all fit together. And, I've been interested in markets for a while, just an interesting puzzle, macroeconomics. And I like the fact that there's a scoreboard and you can have your opinions, but ultimately the scoreboard doesn't lie, whether right or wrong. So there's a check against all of your wild theories ultimately at the end of the day. And so that's what I like. Our philosophy at NDR or at 314, we kind of took and modified what we did at NDR was basically historical quant analysis. So we like to look at, and we'll talk about this with the breadth stuff you mentioned, we like to classify the current market conditions in a certain way, and then go back in history and see what happened. So that's a big part of our, setting the table where we're at. Does this feel like a bull market, the early innings of a new bull market, or are we still in some kind of bear market? And I think history can help us cut through some of the confusion that's out there, because there is a lot of confusion, a lot of angst as well.
So I'm curious, just given your career on the attorney side of things, do you find that some of the skills as an attorney have made you maybe better at looking at macro, made you more skeptical about narratives because you're looking much more from a fact-based perspective?
I think it probably has. It's been a long time for me to own up to that. A lot of times I kind of shrug my shoulders and say, I wasted all my education and I'm not applying anything I learned. And it's probably not entirely true, to be honest. I a lot of this is creating a bull case or creating a bear case and then being able to stand in the shoes of where could I be wrong. And I think being an attorney and crafting arguments and being able to switch from one side of an argument to the other side of an argument with at the drop of a hat, that's a very useful skill to have in markets. I think everyone should be as open-minded as possible. And I always say, strong opinions loosely held. And so that kind of underlying philosophy in the way I approach markets, I think that does probably come from being an attorney. But really, I'd say the bulk of the applicable education came through my ability to play with and manipulate data during my time at Ned Davis. You know, I was fortunate to have access to a lot of data and learned how to code and learned how to set up quant studies. And so I just had a whole lot of questions I wanted to answer, and I went about answering them myself. And then from that process, you gradually develop your own style and your own philosophy and how you approach markets. And that's really, I guess the combination of being an attorney and being able to jump back and forth between arguments, and then my training where it was really the data, letting the data guide us at NDR. Those two things are really the two main ingredients of the way we do our work now.
That point about playing with and manipulating data, I think, is an interesting one, in that when you start doing quant work, you start realizing, I'd argue, how little quant actually matters that people would reference, right? There's some things which are predictive and a lot of things that aren't. In all of your studies and ways of looking at data, what are some of the things that maybe surprised you as not having predictive power that people will reference, and things that tend to have predictive power?
Well, I'll be honest with everybody. It's like, once you start trying to, there's a replication problem, not just in our industry, but in research in general, I'd say. And the replication problem is just a nice way of saying that a lot of these studies are, you know, contorting themselves to come to conclusions to get published and things like that. So there is a that's what I found, is that there's and even at NDR, like I'll speak highly of NDR in my time there and the opportunities it gave me, but I found that there was a tendency to work to create an indicator that renders a really good back test. And, you know, they throw these kind of random indicators into an optimizer and then tell you where to buy and sell. And a lot of these signals will be like, you buy when the bracket's at 41.6 and you sell when the bracket's at 63.2. And what you realize is those, when you get those like not round numbers in there, that's you're overfitting to random noise in history. And there's just a lot of that happens. And it's, if you haven't built studies and backtests and really done it, you can be totally tricked by that. And one of my fun little just ways to entertain myself over the years would be watching people put kind of bad studies into production, and then they have amazing backtests that fall apart in real time. And they don't just, a lot of times these things wouldn't just kind of sort of fall apart. They would totally break down and become contrarian indicators. And so that was, you can easily fall into like kind of a nihilistic pattern if you get to with the quant stuff. But with all that said, I think there is a silver lining, and that's you can ultimately know what's BS and what could be BS, but you know the level that it is or that it has signal. And then you can simplify the world down to the things that actually matter, you know, and there's so many charts and so much stuff that flies at you on Twitter or just in the financial services industry these days. I mean, a big part of, I'd say our advantage is just knowing which things to ignore. There's I'd say 95% of the things are should be ignored versus understood. And then the final point I would make is there is just no substitute for good logical reasoning through a cycle. You know, the quant and historic analysis, it'll get you so far, but you have to use your own, you know, the most, what is the Peter Thiel quote? There's nothing more contrarian than thinking for oneself. I really believe that. I think you need to try to take your quantitative analysis, let it work and put guardrails up for how you see the future unfolding, but also have an appreciation for how each cycle is different and have some logic that underlies your calls.
Yeah, I very much like that point. I find that myself. I think a lot of active managers and traders just in general, they try to chase optimization to the current cycle. And, you know, they end up having all these variables and all these different, you know, perfect optimized look back periods like you referenced or levels. I'm always the mindset that you're better off focusing on one or two things that might explain 50 to 60% of why markets do what they do, and accept the truth, which is that the rest is probably randomness, than try to curve it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And then you have to be somewhat acknowledge when you build your own backtest. Like if you're trying to make a quote unquote good backtest, if you don't catch the 2008 decline, then you're not going to, whatever signal you're testing is not going to work. You, so things like that you have to realize. And then you throw 2020 and COVID in the mix. Like I don't, almost most signals that catch COVID, I'm very skeptical of, because that there was very little in the months, like a normal slow moving cycle leading up to that, that suggested we would have that kind of a drawdown. And there are things you can, there are things that you could confuse for the signal that led up to it as well. But yeah, you have to, you have to have a filter for sure when you're going through these things.
It's like I would think that last year was sort of the real extreme of that, right? Because we've had crashes before, we've had stocks and bonds fall together before. We haven't necessarily had it in the dual sequence, right? Like we did last year, which, you know, at least for me, it was really quite challenging, as well as for risk parity type of strategies. Do you get a sense that the dynamics of last year, if it's sort of a 1 in 100 year or 1 in 1,000 year type of event, that's over, or are we still in this dynamic where it's going to be challenging to diversify across stocks and bonds?
That's a great question. And no, I don't think it's a one and done type of thing. I think I think the one and done thing was the period that we just came through between, call it 1998 and 2021. There was just a confluence of events that basically structurally eliminated inflation for a couple decades from the equation. And when you pull inflation out of the big picture, you stocks and bonds can move opposite of each other, and bonds create a natural hedge for stocks. And just the really simple stat that I like to discuss or talk to clients about is, if you looked at the 100 worst days in the stock market from 1998 through 2021, bonds were up on 83 of those 100 days. And a lot of days they were up big. So they were a risk off asset and a hedge during that period of low inflation. If we roll it back and we look from the 60s up to 1998, and you take the 100 worst equity days, the worst days in the stock market, the S&P 500, it was only 35 of those days that bonds were up. So only 35% of the time did bonds hedge your equity portfolio. And that's what you really care about, is during the stressful periods when there's a 20%, 15, 20, 25% drawdown in stocks, that money's going to flow into bonds. And obviously didn't happen last year. And I think there's a little bit of a false sense of security this year, because you've seen 60-40 come up off the mat. I've seen some people who I really like, so I'm not going to name names, declare that 60-40 was never dead. It's not back, because it was never gone. And the idea is that 60-40's up, you know, that everyone who was trying to say we're out of this regime is wrong. And if you look under the surface, it's been a positive correlation move between stocks and bonds once again in 2023. I would say that's troublesome or worrisome from the perspective of a traditional 60-40 investor. So that's where we're at. If it one final thing, just not to get too quant, but if you hold the return assumptions constant for stocks and bonds, and you in volatility assumptions, and you just only play with the correlation between stocks and bonds, and you move it from the post 1998 regime correlation to the pre 1998 regime correlation, you lose 0.25 sharp ratio point. So you go from like a 0.7 to like almost a 0.4 sharp ratio on your 60-40, just playing with the correlation between stocks and bonds. And so it's a huge deal. You don't really want to rejoice because stocks and bonds are up together. What it tells you is that we're still in this, I think we're shifting out of this regime. And then at the same time, the same people dance on the graves of energy and things like that. And my point has been, energy is a good diversifier, because that's kind of the nexus or the beginning point of certain inflationary pressures. So yeah, the bottom line is, I don't think we're through that regime. I think that, or done with last year's regime. I think it's going to be with us actually going forward. There are reasons, fundamental reasons. I mean, China's no longer going to just, I think the deglobalization theme, it's more of a theme and an idea than an actual reality at this point. But we've had peak globalization at this point. I think it's hard to argue in any other direction there. So peak globalization. Chinese working age population in 1998 or 2000, when they entered the WTO, was shooting higher. And now they're losing tens of millions of working age population every year. It's a huge demographic headwind. We've had the shale revolution. Shale came onto the scene from, you know, call it 2010 forward, and added another headwind for inflation. And basically, Wall Street subsidized negative cash flow projects and subsidized, you know, the cost of energy for the rest of the world. And that's gone. So these major secular forces are changing. And then more than anything, we went through this pandemic. You basically damaged the supply side of the equation, and we still aren't back to fully healed. That kind of goes to the globalization stuff. So you damaged the supply side, and you added something like $8 trillion to the U.S. debt. And that's real stimulus. You know, we hear a lot of people talk about QE and monetary stimulus, but that's kind of pushing on a string. But when you actually, when there's that much money, it's like a 30% increase in the national debt over a matter of a couple years that's pushed out into the real economy. That is inflationary, especially when you push it out into the economy when you've, after you've damaged supply chains. So supply can't respond to this new regime, this new demand. It's not surprising that inflation continues to kind of bubble up and has been more stubborn here as we go through 2023.
So there's a lot that I agree with you on, and I think there's some nuances too, though, which is that obviously when people say bonds, yeah, I think they think more in terms of the idea that all bonds act the same. Treasuries are really kind of your, you know, in quotes, hedge, right? Meaning on the duration side, that flight to safety dynamic, which is what failed so miserably last year. But it's worth noting that even in those kind of 100 days, presumably, even though bonds were up, I think you said a third of the time during those, you know, big down days for equities, presumably if bonds lost during those down days, they still lost a lot less. So it's still, from a down capture perspective, would be beneficial, right? At least to high out in bonds, because you're losing less during those high vol sequences in equities.
Yeah, I mean, all else equal, that's true. And the, just so I'm really clear, the stats that I was citing, what that was for long-term government bonds. But if you look at the, like I said, the point though, using long-term government bonds, or we were using in the 60-40, we're using at, you know, aggregate bond index. So if you use aggregate bond index correlations to stocks pre-1998 versus 1998, to 2021, and you keep every other assumption constant, you're losing, you know, like I said, your Sharpe ratio is going from, I'm pulling the chart up right now, it's your Sharpe ratio on 60-40 is going from 0.75 down to almost 0.5. So you're like, it's a huge reduction in Sharpe ratio, even if it's a little less, even if there's a little bit of a cushion with your bond portfolio, it's a little lower vol asset, you're still not going to have the dynamic, the portfolio dynamic that you had from 1998 to 2021 when we had structurally removed inflation from the equation.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that one bit. Now, you mentioned cycles. I would argue that this year is not exactly playing to historical cycle script so far. Pre-election years tend to be the strongest, right, of the four-year cycle. I've had Jeffrey Hirsch on before going through all that, but at the same time, if you look at small caps, Barron's had a piece or a headline basically suggesting that is the first time in a pre-election year in like 70 some odd years that small caps at this point in the year are down, are performing kind of this poorly, which gets into breadth. Is there anything in your work that would suggest that something's just different this year and beyond the narratives and causations around regional bank crisis and the Fed, just in terms of path behavior? Does something feel off, since you use that term, you know, it feels like a bull market?
Well, I mean, the price action feels like a bull market, but it's anachronistic is what I would, how I would categorize it. Like, this is not where you would expect a bull to crop up in this part of the cycle. So that's my first problem, is the timing of the cycle at REN. We've never seen, I'm sounding like a broken record for anyone who's listened to me, but we've never seen the stock market form a major bottom while the Fed is still in the hiking phase of the Fed cycle. So if October was the low, then this would be the first time. This would be the first time that a bull market formed during that hiking phase of 200 basis points of additional hikes post, quote unquote, the bottom. So that's number one. Number two is the path of earnings. We have seen a little bit, and we can talk about this. Forward earnings typically would, by now, 6 months post-bottom, forward earnings would be back to where they were at the lows, at the ultimate stress. So you have earnings bottom typically about 2 months after the stock market, forward earnings, and then rebound. That's the pattern you would see to confirm this is an actual true stock market bottom. We have not seen that. Earnings, forward earnings continue to grind lower. And so we are kind of getting to a point where I think this is going to be, because the way that 2023 rolls into 2024 and the way 2024 estimates are like a double digit increase over 2023 at this point, if you use blended forward, you're going to start picking up on some little tick higher in earnings. But still, it doesn't look like at this point in time the pattern you would see after a typical market bottom. So earnings aren't like that, aren't behaving the way you expect. And then I also point to the yield curve. So this kind of goes to the Fed cycle, but when you get 6 months out from a major equity low, we've never seen the 2s-10s yield curve inverted before. We've never seen the Fed funds rate 2-year inverted like this at the 6 months post the market bottom. So because the typical cycle is stock market falls, there's some kind of economic weakness that's associated with that. The Fed cuts. The Fed's usually cutting a little before the bottom. But that's how the yield curve uninverts, is through the Fed cutting rates around the bottom. And obviously we've been hiking rates, so it kind of goes to point number one. But still, it all tells me it doesn't feel like the neighborhood of a major equity low. And we could be wrong. This could be a reacceleration. This cycle could be different because of all the fiscal stimulus that preceded it. And so that's a possibility, but it's not our base case. I believe that here we are at like 4,200. So we're, 600 points from 36, and we're 600 points from 4,800, which is basically the all-time high. So if this was a new bull market, then you would make new all-time highs before you hit cycle lows. My bet is that we will hit cycle lows before we hit new all-time highs. Maybe that's not the best prediction, because there's a lot of wiggle room in between there. We can get more fine grained than that, but that's the bottom line. That's the big picture as I see it, is that we are not starting a new run to all-time highs at this point in the cycle with earnings behaving this way. And the big factor obviously is going to be where you place the recession on the chessboard. But those are the three big things. And we can drill into some of the market internals and things like that as well, if you'd like.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hello, listeners. Michael Guyatt here from Lead Lag Live. Are you ready to take a deep dive into market trends, risk management, and investment strategies? Then you need the Lead Lag Report. Our in-depth analysis helps you understand the financial markets like never before. And guess what? We're giving you a chance to experience it at a discounted rate. Visit theleadlag.report/leadlaglive and get an exclusive 30% off on your subscription. Don't miss out. Level up your investment game with the Lead Lag Report. And now, back to our discussion.
Yeah, no, and actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I've been on that point. I shared in the Nest just now this chart that I constantly put out, kind of explains the hell I went through last year with my own strategies. But, on your point about a cycle low, I keep pointing to the fact that last year was the only time in history where long-duration treasuries lost more money than stocks in a top 20 drawdown for stocks. Only time in history that that's happened. But I always put a little asterisk next to that statement, which is that the assumption there is that the drawdown for stocks is over, that the lows are actually in, right? That the October period was it. And my contention, along to those that say treasuries failed as a counter, at least in terms of maybe even just down less, forget about the idea of a inverse hedge, My counter to a lot of people is that the assumption is the drawdown's over. So if it's not over, what if you break the lows and maybe treasuries in that next wave lower for equities, do what they, have done at least in the last, 20 plus years or so, which is counter, at least a little bit, meaning make money if stocks go down and have that kind of convex potential. So what would be, there's always that sort of question of catalyst. And I always myself get cynical around catalysts, because catalysts are only determined after the fact. But if you were to sort of say to somebody, here's what could drive us to cycle lows, here's an event, or here's something that could push us there, what would be sort of your major things to focus on?
The first thing is, when a recession does arrive, I would expect to see you would see that negative correlation at least temporarily come back. As if the recession became the dominant force in squeezed inflation out of the picture, then yes, everyone would run into long-term treasuries. And I believe that will happen before this is all said and done. And, you know, but the big question, the $64,000 question, is when does the recession arrive? And wherever you place that has huge implications for current pricing and how you position yourself and how much time you have before you have to kind of reduce equity position, increase bond position. The thing, to answer your question directly, the thing we're watching to give us a key on the when the cycle's rolling over is the construction industry, specifically residential construction payrolls. We want to see, if you go back and look at recessions, you want to see, you see residential construction payrolls fall by like 8 to 10% leading into a recession. And so that's what we're looking at. And so you really have to get fine grain and look at the what's going on in the housing market. And so we've had this, and it's a longer cycle than people have anticipated. We came into the year saying that recession is a second half story, and it's kind of consensus now. But if you remember back to the beginning of the year, everybody said we're going to walk right into economic weakness in 2023. And we've always thought this is going to be a longer cycle. And I think it could end up being even longer than we thought initially. And that's kind of what you're seeing maybe the stock market get at, is this is kind of more, are we more in 2006 or 2007, to use that analogy right now? But because of the backlog of houses that are out there, you know, new housing starts can fall, but they're not falling enough to reduce the number of houses and units under construction. There are a bunch of other cycles going on in the background too, like multifamily is relatively attractive to single family. So you're still seeing multifamily starts going through, and that's keeping some construction payrolls elevated. So when we put it all together and crunch numbers, we think that you'll get that 8 to 10% drawdown in construction payrolls by November of this year. So that's our position for a recession. But with that said, we had a tick lower in construction payrolls, and they've now ticked back higher. And it's kind of a function of what we're talking about. The housing market is resilient at this point in time. And the more importantly, the construction industry is resilient because of the backlog of houses and the time it takes to complete a home. And that's blown out by, you know, something like 4 or 5 months, according to our analysis, post pandemic. So if it takes much longer to build a house and your starts are falling, but they're not collapsing, then that backlog, which keeps, that's what ultimately keeps people employed in the construction industry. That backlog is more stubborn than it would be in a typical cycle. And that's what we're seeing. So you have to work through all that. Our best guess is a November time for that reduction in construction payrolls. Construction payrolls lead your overall non-farm payrolls in by roughly 4 months on average. But construction is kind of, you know, housing is the economy to a large degree. If you think about the average recession, even though construction is something like 4 to 5% of total jobs in the economy, it represents roughly 15% of the jobs lost in your typical recession. So you're really at the most, the tip of the spear, the leading indicator, whatever you want, for the economy when you're looking at the construction industry. And it's really difficult to get a serious recession with the construction industry still basically at full employment. And so that's where we're at. We need to, the patience is going to have to, we're all going to have to watch those and have those numbers and have patience as this slowdown manifests. But that's what I am watching. Now, is there a way we could avoid a recession altogether? No, I don't believe so. That's the, you know, this is, these are all factors that elongate the cycle. But the bottom line, in my view, is the in real terms, the average house payment right now is $3,000 a month nationwide. And that just, the math doesn't work. If you go back and you look at any construction metric, once that number gets above 2,000, there's a big time slowdown. And we're seeing it right now. We've seen it in, we saw it in NAHB, and there's been a rebound in that. We can talk about why that is, but it's kind of a false signal right now. But you see it in construction spending, you see it in eventually payrolls. And so housing affordability has to come down one way or another before this cycle's over. The only way it can come down is through a reduction in prices. The only way that's going to happen is through a construction, through a slowdown where jobs are reduced and we end up in a recession. So I don't think we are, this whole idea that this no landing hypothesis, I really don't think that there's a path to that. What the best you could hope for is just a really long runway until the recession.
which by the way, to some people might sound counterintuitive. You need to have layoffs in construction, which on the surface makes it sound like less homes being built, which means less supply of homes to prop up existing prices. But if unemployment goes up, then suddenly, I'd argue, also you end up having an unloading of second, third, fourth properties because now you're not getting rental income from those properties. And then, you know, housing prices are set at the margin, right, from a comping perspective. So that all makes sense. And, you know, I've been very colorful on Twitter and in media appearances myself, basically saying I think housing is fucked from a lot of perspectives. And Lumber agrees with me on that. That point about the lags, though, is interesting just because Lumber's been unrelenting on the downside. And usually, you know, there's what I think a 3 to 5 month sort of lag between lumber and you know, housing construction actually taking place. If that's elongated, then if lumber is right, then that probably does mean that probably lines up to your November kind of time frame.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there are some in this cycle, there were some supply issues with lumber that probably created artificially or not artificially, but inflated prices during the pandemic and the supply side. So I'm the only concern I'd have there if you're trying to key off of it is the, if you're going to get the same signal this time around. I think it's much more of just a, you can watch, you know, affordability ultimately is going to drive everything. You just can't make the math work for people to get into new houses to, you know, and you have a bunch of the golden handcuff scenario too, where everybody who has a, you know, a 3% mortgage, it's impossible for them to make the math work to move houses right now. So you just have a grind lower in activity, which ultimately will express itself in lower payrolls, construction payrolls. So I think you have to just ultimately the real factor that matters is houses under construction, units under construction, multifamily plus single family. Multifamily has a few less jobs associated with it than the single family structure. You have to basically combine all that together and then back out what, you know, play with the variables, play with starts, play with the time it takes to complete a home. You know, push, map out some scenarios and then basically say, okay, once we get houses, units under construction to this level, you should expect to see layoffs starting in the construction industry. Also remember, we're starting from a really tight construction labor market. So that's another factor elongating. These builders and anyone in that industry is going to be holding on to employees for dear life. So they'll be hoarding employees even during the first parts of weakness, which is probably where we're at in the cycle. And so those are the things that I'm watching: houses under construction, units under construction, and then the factors, starts and time to build a unit, that flow into that analysis.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Foodies unite with How You Dish. It's social media with a secret sauce. Food, the world's first network for food enthusiasts. How You Dish connects foodies across the world. Share kitchen tips and recipe hacks. Discover hidden gem food joints and street food. Find foodies like you. Connect, chat, and organize meetups. How You Dish makes it simple to connect through food anywhere in the world. So, how do you dish? Download How You Dish on the Apple App Store now.
I would add, I think all that's also consistent with just broader intermarket dynamics that are taking place, right? So if you look at retailers, XRT, you know, the retailer ETF divided by the S&P, you know, it's, you know, breaking down to lower lows. You look at consumer discretionary sector stocks against the S&P, breaking down on a relative basis. Small caps have the effect of the regional banks, but small caps are also tied to the domestic consumer. So my point is that I've made this argument many times, housing is about the consumer. If housing is going to be weak, consumers are going to be weak. And if the market is forward-looking, it does seem like the weakness in consumer-sensitive areas of the stock market, it's all giving the same message around housing, even though it's not as clear of a link to most people just looking at tickers.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think the one thing that we haven't talked about that I have to flag that kind of pushes against it is the ultimate factor elongating the cycle is the amount of money pumped into the system during the pandemic. And so we have a chart on checkable deposits we put on Twitter, and people are always interested in it. We also have a chart that uses the checkable deposits to calculate excess savings. And that's kind of a popular concept out there. in the research world, and excess savings is, I think, a little bit of a sleight of hand trick. But the bottom line is there's a lot of money in the system. Checkable deposits jumped by, I believe, between $4 and $5 trillion during the pandemic. And so that's created a very resilient core to the economy, more resilient than I had anticipated. And I think most people have anticipated. So that's why I think you've constantly seen the predictions for recession get pushed out farther and farther and farther, because there's this core that's very powerful. And what happens is when you have that consumer balance sheets that strong, weird things, you know, it's ultra responsive to stimulus. So the way I explained the early year strength that we saw in the economic data, say retail sales, we saw it in mortgage applications, we saw it across the board early this year. Everyone was scratching their heads. Why are we seeing this reacceleration? In our view, you had, let's just keep it really simple. Long-term rates fell from basically the October bottom all the way through January. So you had the 30-year mortgage go from +7% down to just under 6%. And you saw a reacceleration of mortgage applications. And so I had all that stuff I said about affordability, and that's true and, you know, whatnot. But at the same time, this is a different kind of world where the consumers are flush, and there's a resilient core that's ultra responsive to low rates. So every time we've gotten a backup in those rates that dictate borrowing costs, whether it's, call it between 5 and 30 years out on the curve, every time we've seen a reduction in those borrowing costs, it doesn't matter what the Fed's doing with the Fed funds rate. If the curve's inverting and those borrowing costs are coming down, consumers are going out, and you're seeing it in the car market, you're seeing it in the housing market, you're seeing it in general economic data, retail sales and things like that. And that, to me, is the factor. That's the big variable that's keeping everyone on their back foot this cycle, in my opinion.
So I want to go back again to breadth, because all this, again, I would argue is tied to breadth. Outline for the audience how normal or abnormal the difference is between mega caps and everything else, and what does history tend to suggest about divergences?
Right. So this has been a painful year, because and I hear it from everybody.
Say that again for everybody, because this is I'm so glad you said it that way. It drives me crazy the way people are looking at just the headline averages and thinking it was easy so far.
No, I think the quote that I put in our report from last week was, there's nothing so disturbing as seeing your friend get rich. And that's kind of like, I feel like everyone's experience, it's just the basic, it's just describing underperformance. So anyone who missed the top 10, or let's just call it the big mega cap AI beneficiary tech stocks, if they weren't in those stocks this year, and they weren't in them right when the year began, then you're underperforming and you're having a lot of angst. And so it's a relative game, and that's why everybody, you know, it's not feeling so great. Now, if you had the call on to be overweight mega cap tech going into the year, which is not totally illogical, then good for you. You're feeling good. But the majority of people, it's been a very narrow rally. The majority of it came from January to February 2nd. We had like 7.3% appreciation in the S&P 500 from January 1st to February 2nd. Basically flat after that. The top 10% of stocks have returned about 35% this year. The bottom 490 are single digits in their returns, basically flat. So it's been a very narrow rally. And the way we wanted to study this is by defining it first. And we call this condition a mega cap divergence. And so whenever you see over a 6-month period, the top 10 stocks in the S&P 500 outperform the bottom 490 by 10% or more, that's a mega cap divergence. So we wanted to look at those and study them and see, what does it mean for the market going forward? Is there anything any signal that we can get from this? The lessons of mega cap divergences are that there is a huge dispersion of returns over the next 3-4 months following this, hitting this level. And we hit it in late April in this cycle, just for everyone that's following along.
Which, by the way, I'm not to drop it up, but
no, go ahead.
I've kept on saying something changed the third week of April. And I kept on saying on and on. I think that's the sort of correction. Obviously, large caps, you know, made new highs. Breadth started weakening. It's not really falling apart just yet. But what you're saying independently lines up with what I myself have argued, which is something seems to have altered.
Yeah, we hit that threshold, and it's now we went from a 10% outperformance over a rolling 6-month period to a 25% outperformance over a rolling 6-month period just in the last few weeks. So it's accelerated. We're at the point now where you've only had 3 other cases where mega caps, top 10, the largest cap stocks in the market, have outperformed the bottom 490 over this period of time this much. They're, go back to 2000 during the tech bubble. If you think about the craze with Cisco and all the big cap internet stocks back then, that was the one of the cases. That was the worst case, actually. 2008, around October of 2008, was another one, as you saw a risk off piling into the largest cap stocks, and they outperformed. And then 2020, we also saw it around the COVID market volatility. So those are only 3 times that we've seen this kind of a mega cap divergence. But if you go back, we have, going back to 1990, we found 13 of them. 5 cases, you're higher 3 months later, and sometimes significantly higher. And in 8 cases, you're lower 3 months later. But there's a huge dispersion of returns. And the big thing we found is in the positive cases, the bottom 490 takes the baton and begins to get into gear and lead the market.
A small cash place to catch up, basically.
Correct. These bottom 490 stocks have to take on a leadership role going forward if the market's going to really break out. If you're going to get above the 4,300 August 2022 highs, and this is and you actually want to get bullish here, that's what you have to see. There is a path for it, but that's what we're watching. We're watching percentage of stocks above the 200-day moving average. It's continued to bleed lower. That needs to, you know, stabilize and go higher. You need to see more participation in order for the rally that we saw last week kind of flourish into something more. It's not what we're expecting.
Is there anything to where that happens, the divergence in the year? So yes, I agree with you. Small caps obviously can play catch up. I'd argue the odds are pretty low, even independent of the historical divergences, because we're now in that kind of worst 6 month of May to October period where stocks tend to be on average lower return than the best 6 months. So is there a seasonality aspect to that dynamic?
I didn't see any in the data. It's more around market stress is usually this. We found really it's the only cases that look like this was the tech bubble, which actually did occur. The blow off top in mega cap internet stocks did occur around this same time of the year. It might just be coincidental, but just to your point, obviously 2008 was in the fall and 2020 was in the spring. So those are the only 3 cases where we're anywhere close to the neighborhood we are right now. So I don't know. You could look at that 2000 case, but I would say there are other dynamics other than seasonality. I do agree with you, though, that this is a kind of dangerous time for the market in general. I mean, you need to start seeing the 490 pick up. You probably want to see, I mean, we broke out earnings. I mean, you've seen a little stabilization out of the total S&P 500 earnings. But when you break out the top 10 and look at the bottom 490, you have seen all the improvement concentrated in these big cap tech stocks. And so, again, that's not really what you want to see. You want to see earnings for the bottom 490 stabilize and go higher, kind of going back to that market bottom map, roadmap that I laid out at the very beginning of this conversation. You want to see forward earnings moving higher for the market in general, but you really want to see it, given the breadth that we have in the market, you really want to see the bottom 490 get into gear. No evidence of that yet, but that's the kind of stuff we're watching. We're watching the breadth of the bottom 490. We're watching forward earnings for the bottom 490, and we're watching interest rates, because I think interest rates have been a bit of a tailwind for the market in the last couple months after the banking crisis. And something's wrong. Something between the bond market and the stock market. The views that are baked in for each of them, one of them is, both can't be right, in my opinion. One of them is wrong. And so we're watching rates to see if rates, how rates behave. We expect them to back up a little bit here, and then how that flows into the stock market. The bottom line is, in general, bad things happen. There's a distress signal being sent by the bond market. And you can see that. You can look at the Fed funds rate in 2-year. The way we broke it down here recently was looking at the difference between the implied 12 to 24 month rate versus the current 1-year, the 1 to 12 month rate. So it's just basically, it sounds like a lot, but it's the forward rate differential on that 12 to 24 month period. And if you think about it mathematically, buying a 2-year note, it should be mathematically equivalent to buying a 1 year and then rolling it and buying another 1 year. And the difference, that inversion between the 1 year and the 2 year, another way to think of it is that the market expects the 1 year yield to drop from plus 5% to 3.4% in the next year by the time you roll that 1 year over. So that forward yield, that differential, is the biggest differential that we've ever seen on record. And that's signaling something. If you go back, another great chart that Fernando Vidal, my research partner, put out or came up with was the number of months that the bond is implied in the futures market before the Fed cuts rates. If you look at that chart, and we have it in our service, so I don't think I put it on Twitter, but if you look at that chart, the bond market backed cuts out as we had that economic reacceleration earlier in this year. And we had a lot of the cuts were priced out. And if you remember, the bond market sold off and a lot of these inversions got a little bit better. And then we had the banking crisis, and that those cuts were priced back in. And so the futures market is pricing in cuts, the Fed to cut rates by the end of the year. And I think the probabilities are favorable, more favorable from the cut than hike by, I want to say, September at this point. And there's definitely a higher probability, and it's the expectation that there'll be a cut in November. I don't think that that view can coexist with the equity view. The equity view is we have double-digit earnings growth between 2023 and 2024 coming up. If that's just based off of 23 estimates versus 24 estimates. The only way we get the bond market to make any sense in what it's doing is if we have a recession this year, let's call it like November, like we were saying, or sometime maybe even sooner than that. So that's the bond market's view. That's the only way we get the Fed to cut. That's the only way that these differentials and things that we're seeing, the inversion between the Fed funds rate and the 2 year and anything else you want to look at, it's the only way it makes sense. Yet the stock market thinks we're getting double digit earnings growth. One of these two markets is going to be very wrong, in my opinion. And I'm open-minded. Y'all listen to, I could hear arguments that, you know, the recession keeps getting pushed off. And then, so you have to bake back these cuts out. That's possible. But the one thing I can say is that they're not going to coexist for much longer, these two views.
Do you think any of that has to do with the debt ceiling? I know that sounds a little bit silly because we all know it's going to get resolved, but you look at credit default swaps, somebody's betting on something. And I think people forget that with 2011, it wasn't necessarily the debt ceiling. It was the shenanigans around the debt ceiling that resulted in the debt downgrade that caused that summer crash. I mean, I've been kind of thinking about this more recently. And if Biden were to invoke the 14th Amendment, you remove the debt ceiling altogether, I would think S&P has to say something.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's what's going on, because we're looking out at, that's why we chose to look at the 1 year versus a 1 year forward rate. And that's really what we're looking at, that 12 to 24 month versus the next 12 months. You can see some mispricing or weird pricing in the, and so that, just to be clear, like the 1 month and 3 month is in there in that 1 year, and that could be elevating it a little bit. So on the margin, that could be a factor, right? But I don't think it's the major factor. You can see the difference between the 1 month and the 3 month treasury bills right now, if I'm not mistaken. And I think that kink where the no one wants to own the 1 month is basically, that's really what the debt ceiling kink that you see in the curve. So to me, that's more of a very, very front around this event risk and when this X date falls and all that stuff, versus the full 1 year versus the 2 year. I don't think it's the proximate cause. I think it goes back to the Fed cuts and the recession, the imminent recession that the bond market's forecasting.
I think a large amount of what's called the FinTwit community was very bullish on commodities in 2023. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on where we are in the commodity cycle, because a lot of the arguments have not changed around underinvestment and we need more things out of the ground. But if you have a recession, kind of those bets are, I would think, off. Where are we in commodities in the context of everything that you're looking at?
Yeah, I spend a lot of time. Oil is really that quintessential commodity, and so that's where I think I'd probably take the answer. I think that, again, our view is a second half recession. That was our view going back at the end of last year, going into the year. We thought, just to be back off and give everyone a total holistic view, we thought the market would be range bound between like 3,600 and 4,000 as a rough range for the first half of the year. And then we'd make new lows in the second half of the year as the recession came. We thought also that the first half of the year into the second half, you'd have a window to play higher oil prices. And that obviously has not materialized. And so I still think that our model is flipped long crude oil in late March, or fortuitously just before the OPEC announcement for cuts. And it's still on a buy signal. And I believe that things are lining up for a nice rally for crude oil. And that's because it's a very late cycle asset. I know that we're all talking about the recession. Stocks are discounting recession. You have earnings that you can look out in the future for the stock market. The oil is the shortest duration asset on the menu. It doesn't discount the future. It's all about supply and demand balances here and now. Of course, there are paper factors too, and physical and future market factors that can affect it in the very short term as well. But it's not looking out and saying, you know, and if you try to trade oil this way, which I think some people are, you're going to get burned. If you're shorting like gas oil, for instance, or refined products or anything in petroleum complex with the idea that you're going to, you know, use that as your recession, your way to express a view on a recession, I think it's a really dangerous game, because these things can rally right up into and through the beginning parts of a recession. That's the lesson of history. If you go back and look at 2008, we made new all-time highs in the price of oil in July of 2008. The recession was officially declared at the end of 2007. It's a very late cycle asset. So the bottom line is I think there is definitely a window in the rest of this year where, and given what I just said about the resilience of the economy and the fact that things continue to elongate this cycle, I think it's a good play going forward, crude oil.
And presumably China is a big part of that as well.
China has been the big flying ointment. I think everyone who is worried about a U.S. recession is a little bit and is trying to sell oil or sell something in the petroleum complex based on a U.S. recession. I think that's misplaced. The problem for the bulls, and myself included, has been the time it has taken China to come back to the market. Now, if you look at some very technical kind of inside baseball things that are happening, though, I think we're getting to the end of that. Number one, of course, OPEC is removing, you know, we'll see what I think their cuts are going to be for real. So you'll see 1 million barrels a day at least of oil removed from the market from the supply side due to OPEC actions. But China, more importantly, you're seeing the first signs the demand is truly starting to awaken in China. The beginning of the year, the way it works is they assign export quotas to the country's refiners for petroleum products. And so they jacked up their export quotas for petroleum products at the very beginning of the year. The idea is that many of the nation's refiners had front run the opening and kind of hit tank tops and had too much product sitting around. At the same time, there were some fat margins sitting in the global marketplace. So they upped the state upped export quotas for products. And then you saw, if you look at just regional crack spreads, so refining margins in the region, they've collapsed from January when this happened till recently. Well, China is now cutting back on export quotas by more than 50% for refined products. I would expect to see those regional refining margins tick higher, firm up. When that happens, you also at the same time have a net short position from managed money. And this is all a little technical, but this is the kind of stuff you have to look for at the beginning of a bull market, from the managed money group of traders, that's hedge funds and CTAs basically, who are net short gas oil futures on the ICE exchange. I think if you get China actually strengthening the refined product, the middle distillate market, that flows over there and you could have a real powerful bull market. Now, you're seeing shorts across the petroleum complex. A lot of people layered on shorts coming through this banking crisis. I think those shorts are going to be, I think they're going to be burned before this is over. And so that's fuel for a bull market from my seat.
Warren, for those that want to track your work aside from Twitter, how do people find what you put out?
I mean, really, Twitter is the best place to see just some updates and some free research. If you're an institutional investor, if you're curious about taking a look at our research, you can reach out to us. Be happy to take your information, get on a call even, and you know, potentially get you on the service or trial it a little bit. And so that's on our website, 314research.com. foodies.com. Just put your name in there and we'd be happy to get in touch with you. If you don't, if you're not an institution that qualifies, then just, you know, follow along on Twitter. We're pretty generous with what we put out.
I'm glad you did not say if you're not an institution, tough shit.
I one thing I would first say is I've been doing a Substack on just energy, and it's not the full institutional level of analysis or handholding, but gives you a good idea of how we look at the energy and oil markets every week on Substack. That's the Energy Cable. So you could check that out too if you are an individual investor and just want to get an idea of how we look at the world.
That's a good place to wrap this Twitter space up. Thank you, Warren. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Cheers, everybody.
The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at Lead Lag Report on X, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and check out the Lead Lag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets.